Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. Yes, that is the title of the garden program here on Utah Public Radio. And thank you to Barbara Middleton of North Logan. She's the one who submitted the idea for the name, and through listener feedback, this is what we decided to do. So thank you for joining us on The Zesty Garden. And our first guest with this new title is Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist. And there's a lot to talk about, a lot to get going on, and we hope that you'll stay with us through the program. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. And there's a new book that you've put out, Dan. I don't know how you found time to even do it, but this looks really nice.
You know, I figured that if I was going to come to the garden program this morning, I'm going to have to get used to the Zesty Garden, because I'm so used to calling it something else after how many years we've done this together. But it was really
like the garden show. So.
Yeah, the garden show. It's been a real pleasure to be involved with this, and I'm so honored to be the first guest. That, you know, to me says something about what you guys think of what I do. So, we've got a book out. It's called A Guide to Common Gardening Questions, that together with Katie Wagner and Sean Olson and myself, we developed as a way to address many of the gardening questions that our listeners have and that the citizens of the state have. And it's available at garden.usu.edu, or you can go to the Utah State University Extension website and then just look for gardening questions or something like that, and it'll take you to the cart. And the cart is essentially the place that you would purchase things online. The publication, I think, costs $12 or $14. It's about 120-some-odd pages long. It took us a whole year to develop it and to get it together and get it printed. It's a pocket-sized book, essentially. That's the sheets are laminated, covered, so that you can take it out into the garden with you. You can look at pictures. You can look at tables. You can look at the charts that are in there and start to, you know, answer some of the questions that you may be having, or to at least begin to formulate a better question. The question that I hate our listeners to give me is, I have a problem in my garden and it kind of looks like this. And it's not descriptive enough to really tell me what's going on. And many of our extension specialists around the state, many of our extension educators around the state have said the same thing. They get these kind of cryptic questions that come from the public, and we've kind of compiled those over the last few years and said, well, what resources do we have available to help the listener or help the gardener in the state solve those types of problems? And we have a lot of that information already. Many of you probably have used our vegetable fact sheets and stuff like that. But this is kind of more general. This is, says, I'm going to start gardening. What do I need to know about soil? What do I need to know about planting dates? What do I need to know about planting? What do I need to know about tunnels? What do I need to know about whatever? And this guide has it all. So this is
basically a compilation of the most asked questions.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot. You know, if we get down to asking those questions, I think what you'd find is that at the very beginning, we kind of give them the top 10 questions that have been asked. That's kind of where we started the book with. You know, and if you look at that, the top 10 questions that are often done are, you know, why do I get this white powdery stuff on the leaves of my squash? You know, and you would know that as powdery mildew, but not everyone knows that. You know, why do squash fruits fail to enlarge or mature properly? That's a very common question that we get. You know, another one, tomatoes or peppers have a brown or black spot at the blossom end. what causes that?
Calcium deficiency.
Yeah, well, you know that, and I know that, but not everyone knows that. Here's another one. When should pear fruits be harvested? So Dr. Black would talk to you about that. You know, tip fill in sweet corn. Why doesn't the kernels go all the way to the tip of the ear? People ask that question. I get that question about 10 times every year. Hopefully, well, by reading this, they'll address that.
And they should listen to the program.
Well, I know
they should. That every
I know.
Year.
I know we do. But nonetheless, that happens. So what we figured that if we could develop a book like this that they, you know, the gardener could use, it has a lot of the generic stuff that you need to know, plus it's reference to all of the more detailed information that the fact sheets at the university already has in place. And, I mean, there's literally hundreds of those. And right now it's in book form, but eventually by midsummer, I would suspect we'll have this set up as a PDF type of file that will have hyperlinks in it so that if you download that file, you could say, oh, I need to know more about tomatoes. I know that I have this black spot on the end of my tomato fruit. I've learned what that is, but I want to learn more about tomatoes. I can click on a hyperlink that would take you right to that particular piece of information that says, this is how I grow tomatoes in my vegetable garden, because somebody may not know that. And so we're trying to create a way for people to, you know, quickly access information and to be able to have at their fingertips, you know, everything that I know. Well, not everything, but most of
now
what
that,
I
there,
know.
There wouldn't be a large enough book to
that's
fit all
true.
That in.
It's a lot more than that. But it's a compilation of, I think, what are the most important parts. And so, you know, Katie and Sean and I, you know, took this endeavor on a year ago. It took us that long. We had a lot of help from other extension personnel around the state. They've reviewed sections of it. They've contributed things to it. And we kind of were just the organizing force. And so I brought some along today, and I thought maybe we could give it out to a couple listeners.
Well, why not?
If we get some good questions. If we just say, I'm calling in for that, I need to have a question too, something that's, you know, what I think is worthy of, you know, of having this. And then hopefully the, you know, UPR can send that out to whoever those persons are, and we can get that information on.
Well, here's the 800 number, 1-800-826-1495. So we have two of these books, A Guide to Common Garden Questions, Step-by-Step Recommendations for Successful Vegetable and Fruit Production. And the first two callers or emailers will send this to you, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also email us at zestygarden@gmail.com. So I'm looking at that. It'll be kind of fun to get our first email.
Yeah, we haven't had one of those
yet. zestygarden@gmail.com. All right. So I want to ask, though, it says for fruit production in northern Utah. So is there a southern Utah edition?
We are
out?
Working on that one. And we're working with some of our extension educators from the south. There's going to be a few new things that have to come into it, some of the planting date information. But this would be essentially everything from
Cedar City North.
Cedar City North, yeah. Yeah. And we're going to have a few additions that will tie in the kind of, it doesn't include maybe the Moab area so much, you know, and then everything there around.
Because Moab's actually in, kind of in between
Cedar
City and St. George.
It's kind of an oddball location, and there's a few other one of those. But, I mean, if you're down Monticello way, this is appropriate for Monticello, even though it kind of says northern Utah. There are some, you know, connections to that. And even I think some of our southern people can use this information. The only thing that they would have to, you know, pay a little bit more attention to would be, you know, kind of understanding the planting date stuff as well, because planting dates are going to be quite a bit earlier, and that kind of information is already available, and they could contact their county extension person down in the south and get that information from them.
Well, we have our first caller. Was it Mike in Vernal? Yes. Hi, Mike. Go ahead with your question.
Well, I'm interested in fertilizing my lawn this year, and IFA has this. Maybe I shouldn't talk about a specific company.
You can talk about what's available to you, and then I'll give you my recommendation.
But they recommend, you know, they have a four part system that should go from spring through fall, and I I'm a little worried that, you know, maybe that's too formulaic and may not apply to my particular soil.
Well, you know, I think if they're out there, that four-part system that people have used around the state has worked fairly well for, getting the kind of nutrients that are needed at particular times of the year, and some of these things also are formulated with some weed management, chemicals in the mix in an attempt to try and not only deal with the fertility needs, but also some of the weed control needs that are there. So, the big issue is, you know, do you know what your soil has already? That's the first question that I have ask. And have you done a soil analysis to actually determine what elements are maybe in short supply? And then when you think about a good fertilizer program for your lawn or for your fruit trees or for your vegetable garden, then that helps make better decisions. I mean, it's easy just to go out and put fertilizer down. But you may not need all of those elements. You may have already been using phosphorus and potassium over the past couple of years, and you have plenty of that in your soil that you don't really need to add maybe anything other than nitrogen. And then the question comes, is the amount of nitrogen that you put on going to create another issue for you that your grass is growing so vigorously that you're spending a lot of time mowing it? I mean, I've always advocated that I like my grass to be green, but I also like to sit in the shade of a tree and drink lemonade in the summer. and maybe you're a different kind of guy. I have a friend in town here. He mows his lawn twice a week, and this is his therapy away from his work, because his work is stressful, and he finds that, you know, he puts his muffler or his hearing protectors on, gets the lawn mower going, and he just walks around his yard and mows the grass, and that's his therapy. So, I mean, you know, it might be cheaper than going down to the doctor, that kind of therapy too. So it's hard for me to say.
So you're recommending soil analysis, definitely.
Well, you know, if you don't know, you know, certainly go and chat with a local extension educator there in Vernal and say to him, look, I'm wondering about these programs. I don't really know what I have, and he can kind of help you figure out, okay, I'll take a soil analysis, we'll get it, and then we can start to make some better decisions. Because, you know, you can buy these fertilizers, you can spend a lot of money on them, and then you find that, oh, well, maybe they aren't really doing what I really want them to do anyway. And you don't know that unless you really do the analysis. And so you've got some upfront cost in getting the analysis done, but you could actually save yourself a lot of money by just saying, well, I need some spring nitrogen to get the lawn going, and I need some, maybe had some iron problems, so I really maybe need some iron, but I don't necessarily need phosphorus and potash, and most of these fertilizers are kind of a complete program, so they have a little bit of everything in them, and they're kind of designed to say, well, this is what we know from a standard perspective, so, you know, it's easy for people to just say, oh, I'll just do this.
Wonderful. I that's where I'll go.
Okay, well, good luck with that, then.
Did we get your address so we could send you this book?
No, but that sounds great.
Well, we'll have our producer get your address, and okay, then we'll get that sent out to you.
So hang on to the line there.
Great. Thanks for your question.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. Our next question actually comes, we've got two that are online, Dan, and one is from Joan, and it says, I'm anxious to get veggies going. I have raised beds around my back porch, west-facing. Can I get things like peas, et cetera, planted earlier than if the beds were in the ground?
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that I was hoping that we could talk about this morning. With a raised bed, I'm going to start sowing onions tomorrow in some of my research work. So the types of things that we could plant right now, as soon as that soil dries out sufficiently, that you can do a little bit of raking off, prep the ground a little bit, you know, get stuff in the ground, are things like onion, spinach, early lettuce, a lot of the other leafy greens, radishes, carrots, pea, beet, you know, all of those things. Actually, we can start thinking about seeding if your ground is open. Now, if you have a west exposure, like she's saying, that's going to catch a lot of afternoon sun. It's going to warm up nicely. Those soils are going to dry out quite quickly. There's no reason not to start. The weather's been, opening up. Certainly across out of the Cache Valley region anyway, the ground has been free of snow for more than a week. We still got a wee bit on the ground here, but
I was going to say, it depends on where you live.
Where you live, that's
my
right.
My garden's still got about 3 inches. I'm counting down the hours. Yeah. I'm thinking it'll be gone by the end of the day.
Yeah, and if not today, for sure tomorrow, because it's going to be pretty warm. And my yard is pretty much open now. And I've got a little bit more of a south and a west exposure, and so it catches a lot of sun, and the snow is pretty much gone. But the ground is still a little wet because I didn't make any raised beds, though I have a few beds right up against the south side of the house that I've got some strawberries in, and they're already starting to push some growth, and I'll be this weekend seeding some early spinach and some early lettuce in those for the table, because I've got a small amount of space to do that in. And so, yeah, if you've got open ground and it's dry enough for you to get in there and start, kind of raking the surface off, and if you've pre-made those beds, that's the key thing. You've pre-made your beds in the fall, and we've advocated that for years. Then that, in a small section of your garden, that allows you an opportunity to really get going quickly. And with the cold soils that we have, you may want to pre-sprout your peas, particularly in the far north here. What I find is that's a good way to do it. So I just wrap them in some moist paper towel, put them in a paper or a plastic bag, but I don't seal the bag up so that, you can get some air in there, and it just helps keep it, from drying out too quickly. And then I actually wait until those pea seeds sprout, and so you can see the little root coming out of the seed, and then I plant them. Then I know they're already starting to grow, and I put them in the soil, and they, grow that much faster, and they kind of get through some of those early steps of germination that are a little bit slow when the ground's still a little bit cool.
So how long would you leave them?
Well, the peas might only take 5 or 6 days for them to sprout. So, if you get them started here, early next week, you could be planting those. And then by that, within a week or so, you'll start seeing the little shoots starting to come up too. They come up that much quicker because they're already growing. They're easier to handle because they're a big seed, a pea seed is. It's really hard to try and do some of those things when you're, sowing a lettuce seed or something. So just sow those things out, sow them heavy, get them in place, get them started. And if you really want to kind of kickstart them, just take a little sheet of clear plastic and kind of build a little tent over top of your beds. Now you're going to capture that much more radiation. You're kind of creating a greenhouse-like effect, and they're going to grow even that much quicker. And, you'll get some warmth down inside there, and the plastic, will really do a nice job of that.
Okay, so it won't get them so warm that they don't like to germinate.
No. You may on a bright sunny day, if it's going to be 50 or 60, kind of just flip that plastic black a little bit so that it doesn't get terrible hot. And then at night you pull it back down. And what you're trying to do is it's really those cool nights that we still have that the soil temperature drops back down to, quite a low level. And that's what kind of slows up this whole germination process. You're right on some of these vegetables. If it gets too warm during the day, that may slow up the germination as well. And so while plastic heats things up, you have to kind of understand the concept of, what's the upper threshold for plant growth. And generally we would say, somewhere in the mid-80s is probably where that starts to occur. And so you could actually take a small thermometer, measure the soil temperature, and kind of use that as a gauge to say, it's getting warm out today. I probably should just crack open that plastic so that some air gets underneath there and it doesn't get so terribly warm.
Now, if I could have gotten peas in 2 weeks ago, I would have done it.
Yeah. But,
and I got them in on the 17th, so St. Patrick's Day last year. I don't think I'm going to quite make it this year because I want that soil to be a little bit drier. But still, get them in as early as you can. And now I typically will plant them almost as close together as I can get the seed all the way down the row.
Yeah.
Is that too close?
Not really.
Because I've never seen any problem with
it. Well, not all of them come up, though, either, do they?
Right.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's usually the reason why when we're looking at the looking at something like pea, I found in the past when I do grow them, I sprout them, and that way I know that those are the ones that, because when you look at all the ones you put in to sprout, not all of them have sprouted. And so this way I'm assured that, oh, these have sprouted. I stick them out into the garden. I'm going to be much, much more likely that those are going to establish as plants. And then I still space them about 2 inches apart anyway, and I get this nice heavy row of peas that will be for snap peas or something like that.
Well, let's talk about the different types of peas, because I get, that's one of those questions I get all the time. People don't sometimes understand what a snow pea is versus an edible pod versus a sugar pea, and not knowing that some are the same and some are different.
And you know, if you, the ones that you talked about, is a snow pea basically is a pod that's flat, doesn't tend to have too much seed formation in it, tends to be rather thin walled. So the wall of the, what we're consuming is pod wall, is tends to be relatively thin. The sugar snap pea is a little bit larger type pea. It's got a thicker wall to it. And then a snow pea, they're all basically the same thing. We're not interested in the seed itself. We're just interested in eating the pod wall or the pod itself, kind of like a green bean. We don't really care about the seed in the green bean. We just want to eat the pod. And that's what you're doing with a snow pea or an edible potted pea or a sugar snap pea. And so essentially they're the same thing. And the only difference is how thick that pod wall is, because snow peas tend to be fairly thin walled and the snap pea tends to be fairly thick walled.
So snap pea is what you would think of as a regular pea.
No, it isn't. Now, regular pea is where we're actually growing it for the seed itself. So if you buy frozen peas or canned peas, you're really buying the seed. That's what you're consuming. You're not interested in the wall, the pod wall and stuff, the casing that surrounds the seed. So on the edible potted ones, the snow peas, the snap peas, all of those, you're eating pods, but you're not, there's tiny little seeds in there, but they aren't allowed to grow and swell and get large. And so that's a different part of the plant that we're consuming. And then the seeded pea, that would be, you know, a little French pea or something like that. We're really interested in that small, tiny seed that's developing within the pod. And so they're two really kind of different types that are there.
So what would you use a snap pea for? I'm thinking the snow pea, that's what I would want to put in a salad.
Right.
A snap pea, is that something that you would use in Chinese cooking?
Yes. You'd saute it or something like that. I mean, you can consume them.
So more for cooking, where the other one's more for fresh.
That's right. But you can use the snap pea for your salads and things like that. If I have them, that's what I do with them. I just kind of dice them up a little bit and throw them in there. They're sweet. They're tasty. They're, add some different textures and flavors to your salad. So you can use them that way, but you can also cook them. But the snow pea, you could do the same thing with. You can use them in a salad if you want. You can cook them if you want too. It's just how thick the wall is on them. And on some, the wall, which is the outer seed encapsulating part of the plant, some of them tends to be thicker, some of them tend to be thinner. The snow pea tends to be very thin. The snap pea tends to be quite thick.
So if you do use snow peas for cooking, you would just have to adjust your temperature and cooking time.
Yeah, they're going to cook really fast. That's exactly right if you do those. And so it might take a few minutes longer for the other one. Both of them tend to be fairly quick, as you're going through a cooking process. Both of them can be used in your salads if you so desire.
So if you're looking at just a regular pea, how do you decide what to plant? I know so much of it is trial and error, and here I've been growing since I was about 3 or 4 years old, and I'm just now deciding there's a certain variety I planted last year. I'm going to do that one again because it was so good, but I keep trying things all the time.
You know, in our gardening guide, we've gave a few recommendations. About 15 years ago, I had a publication called Vegetable Varieties for Utah, and I got, you know, basically butchered by people on it. And so I've given up trying to do that. One of our county staff is going to resurrect a trialing program where she's going to look at varieties for the home garden, and she's going to do different ones every year. And I think this year she was going to kind of concentrate her effort on, you know, some newer or, you know, supposedly better peppers and tomatoes and eggplants, and then also some broccoli and that kind of stuff, because, you know, it's hard to do. And we were talking about it yesterday, and she was asking me, well, Dan, how do you decide which one to grow and trial? And I said to her, that's why I don't do it anymore, because I know there are 700 tomato varieties available. 700. So
does that include all of the old heirlooms?
This is the heirlooms and new hybrids and all the different fruit shapes that are out there. And, you know, whether you're talking about cluster types or grape types or pear types or plum types or, you know, small fruited types or large fruited types or you name it. Okay.
So you could take a full acre and just try that with just tomatoes.
I said to her, now, how do we decide from that 700 how many we're going to do? I said, let's say we could do 25 this year. I said, so there's 700. So how many years is it going to take me to go through that? Well, that's be 4 times 7. So it's going to take me 28 years.
Entire career almost.
That's right, my career. I've been here now going into my 22nd year, and if I had started this, and that doesn't even include the new ones that come out this year. I mean, I'm just taking what's already there. So it's a never-ending, impossible task to actually accomplish. And so we're going to try a strategy where we have master gardeners around the state of Utah, and we're going to send them a letter, and it's going to say, we're doing these types of plants this year. Tell us what you grow, the varieties that you grow, and then using some different scaling approaches, tell us about what you like about the plant shape, about the fruiting time, about the fruit quality, about the flavor, you know, from your perspective. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take all of that information together. And then from that, we're going to say, oh, these are the varieties that constantly show up that people like. And these are some of the varieties that constantly show up that people don't like. And, well, we're going to exclude all the ones we don't like. Or we may say, here are varieties that people have tried that they don't like them for this reason, so that somebody else doesn't make the same mistake. Because we really don't want people to make the same mistake. And so we're going to create this database that's driven by our gardeners, and it expresses the interest of those gardeners because they are looking at all these things, so that you could contribute and say, well, over the last, you know, 2 years, I sampled and evaluated these pea varieties, or I did these carrot varieties, or I did these beet varieties. And ultimately, we're going to find winners and losers, and we'll be able to put that in so that people have more information. But we're not going to say, you know, these are ones that have been successful, these are ones that have been unsuccessful or have these kind of flaw characteristics to them, and let people be able to make their own choices then. Because I know my taste for a tomato is going to be very different than yours, and it's going to be different than the next person's. And so when I pick a winner, I'm picking a preference for myself, and you may not like that. You may not like the acidity that's in it, or you may not like the sweetness that's in it. You may not like the juiciness of it. You may not like the dryness of the tomato fruit. And so I can't really tell you what one you should grow until you grow them. But at least now you have a list and says, well, I'm looking for these kind of characteristics. I can then go to this site and I can start to, you know, whittle through those 700, so to speak. And then you still need to do some trialing. A good gardener trials all the time and says, I'm never completely satisfied with what I'm growing. I'm going to always try something new, something that kind of maybe changes my perception of these fruit types or these plant types or flavor types, you know, whatever your criteria is. And so it becomes very difficult for me as a person to be able to do that and say, well, grow these. All we did was kind of compile a list and said, these are ones that are commonly grown. And people came back to me and said, you didn't have the one I liked
on
the list.
Yeah, I know. I was just looking at the list. Well, this one's not on there. And yeah. And then, it's got to be a basic list to start with.
A generic list. Yeah. And then you like that one. That one never has done well. I don't know how many times I got people blasting me on that one. And so I finally just said,
It could be soil conditions.
It could be so many things. So yeah. I'm kind of, you know, a little bit gun shy right now. I'm just not wanting to put myself out there and get hammered again. So we're going to try a different approach.
Let the people decide. You know, I can see this like TripAdvisor, where people sign in, they give it a rating, what kind of soil conditions they were growing it in, and then voila.
And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to kind of just, you know,
garden advisor.
Kind of work our way through these lists and say, well, let's start with, you know, what most people like to grow and work from there, and then eventually move into some of the more obscure stuff. Because, you know, you might be able to say, well, for asparagus, yeah, there's only, you know, maybe 10 varieties that are out there. You know, we could list them all. But I would rather us to say these are ones that the people think are tasty, have good characteristics to them, grow well in there along a variety of different areas. And then, you know, you can say, oh, I really should pick this one rather than that one. And so we're going to kind of work our way through it. It's going to take us a few years, but at the end of this year, we'll have our first set of information. We can then talk about that, let people know where it is, and then we're just going to continue to use these individuals. And then hopefully maybe what we do over time is we create kind of a website or something that will allow people to kind of come in and basically fill in this information, click on these few, you know, boxes that say, I liked it or I didn't like it. These were why I did or why I didn't think it was doing well. And it kind of helps us, and it starts to compile this information, and then it starts to categorize these different types of plants or different varieties so that, you know, people then, you know, have more information. And then they could also then start to sort it and say, well, you know, something that does well in Logan might not do as well in Layton, and it might not do as well as in Leverkin. So if we as we see that, then what we can say is, whoa, these did well in Leverkin. Let's start there and work out from it. And so it becomes a different way of trying to gather information. And I think, you know, it certainly is better than me try to pick winners and losers.
Well, and I'm just thinking, even if you do just 25 varieties and trial them, you have got to do it more than 1 year, because what if 1 year, I mean, the last couple of years it's either been really cold or it's been really hot. I mean, there's nothing
absolutely.
In between.
So. I mean, this is why, you know, people just think, why don't you do this? Because people don't think about the things that I think about. Because I'm thinking about this stuff every day. This is what I'm paid to think about. And I'm going, it's an impossible task. Because when I do, like for our commercial onion growers, I run varietal evaluations for them. You know, last year we evaluated, I think, 35 different hybrid lines of onions for those growers. This year, I think we have 32 or 33 in the trial, and they're what the seed companies send me, and they want to know because, you know, the variety that may do well in Utah might not do very well in Idaho or in Washington or in Colorado where these other areas are, and they kind of want to know local information. But to the commercial onion grower, it's really valuable information because, you know, he can only do so much on his farm, but if I have those trials running, then it's much easier for him to make some decisions that can say, well, this has the bulb characteristics that I want. It has a kind of skin on that bulb that I want. It has this kind of maturity characteristic, you know, and I can work with that. That's something that I can do. But when it comes to the garden, I mean, look at all the plants that we grow. It's really hard. And I don't even really run as many vegetable variety trials as we probably should for our commercial farmers, simply because it's kind of this overwhelming task that's almost too hard for us to do. And so as our listeners you know, kind of start to think about that, and we discuss it a little bit more here. It's helpful, and so we got a list in our gardening guide that says, well, here are some of the ones that we know have done well over the years. It's a starting point. You may have grown some of those before and don't like them, and you've moved on to something else, but for a new gardener, it's a safe place to start. And then, as I say to everyone, is you really need to be saying, well, you know, I shouldn't just kind of go with the status quo. I need to do a little bit of trialing on my own. And I put two of these side by side, and then I see, oh, this one is actually has a different growth habit. It flowers a little bit better when it's hot, or it doesn't flower very well when it's hot. I can kind of, through the process of elimination, you know, begin to change my own preferences.
I planted four different varieties last year, and one of them was one I hadn't ever planted before, and it was, oh, just luscious. I mean, but the tendrils are really tight and curly. It's a different looking plant, but the peas were just absolutely marvelous. But I'm thinking, again, along your lines, it might have something to do with the soil. I mean, all of my family loved it. There wasn't anyone who tried it who didn't love it, but maybe it had something to do with the conditions that made it just a little bit better.
That's the trouble with this. We do these trials. They're pretty much site-specific in some cases. And, you know, I've had even our commercial farmers that have said that to me. Yeah, you know, you did this trial at such and such a place, and when I took it to my farm, I didn't think it was the same. There was something different about it. And then it's like, well, what was different? Is it just purely an environmental thing? Is it the soil conditions? Is it, you know, the soil flora and fauna that's there? Is it, who knows? And so it's not the easiest thing to do. And there are people that trial things like that all the time, and the public wants this information. That's the first place they start. What variety? That's the first question I ever get from saying, what variety should I grow? I don't give that information because you're going to hate me at the end of the summer when I suggest something that you don't like. So I don't want you to hate me. I want you to love me. I want you to come back to the program on a week-by-week basis. And our goal and our job, I think, as specialists and as extension personnel, is to provide useful information. And that sometimes I believe that that's not helpful information.
Well,
it's useful, but it's not always helpful.
It will be useful and helpful with this new website getting the listener.
Yeah, so we're working input. Our way through that. Yeah. And then what we're going to also do at the same time is actually we're going to do some trialing. And we'll take some of the product that's developed from those trials, and then we'll use the public to help us kind of taste test it, evaluate it, and we can do that through some partnerships that we have at some of the farmers markets and those kinds of things. It's a place for us to say, hey, we've got this product here, look at it, tell us what you think of it. Try it, and then, you know, give us what you believe are its strengths and its weaknesses, because that just helps us get more information. And, you know, like I said, we can't do – if we had 50 tomato varieties in front of you as a taste test, by the time you've eaten your third one, you can't tell the difference between anymore. So, I mean, you know, it's hard work. And so many times we avoid doing it simply because, you know, we know that the information we're going to get from it isn't that helpful.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be back in about a minute and a half, and we'll have an email question from Maria that we'll get to as soon as we get back. So we hope you'll stay tuned. It's The Zesty Garden here on Utah Public Radio.
Winter is often the time we break out the pruners and start shaping trees and shrubs. Before making that first cut, be sure you're pruning with a purpose in mind. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Strive to maintain the tree's natural shape and form. You'll have a longer-lived, healthier, and more attractive plant. Prune young trees to establish a strong framework. Ongoing pruning should maintain this strong structure and healthy growth, as well as remove damage, hazards, and improve flowering and fruiting. Wait 2 to 4 years after planting to start pruning young trees for structure. The more top growth on a young plant, the more leaves to produce energy and help the tree become established. Start by removing any crossed, parallel, or crowded branches. Develop a framework of evenly spaced branches spiraling up the trunk. These branches should be as perpendicular to the stem as possible. The wide crotch angles, like those seen on oaks, are stronger and more resistant to wind, rain, and snow damage. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
UPR is made possible with a program day sponsorship from listeners Todd and Liz Fallis of North Logan, recognizing the volunteers and organizers of this Friday and Saturday's Celtic Night 2013 benefit concert for Cash Humane Society and Four Paws. Support also comes from the Best Western Antlers, 423 West Main Street in Vernal, featuring a breakfast buffet, outdoor heated swimming pool, fitness center, guest laundry, Wi-Fi, business services, and a shuttle to the Vernal Airport. Information is at bestwestern.com.
Welcome back to the second part of the Zesty Garden. We've been talking actually so much we only have about 10 minutes left in the program. So,
you need to just tell me, Dan, you know, just kind of stop a little, slow down a little.
No, it was a good conversation. Yeah. I liked it. So if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he'll be the guest through the rest of the hour. It's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. So we have a question from Maria. She says, I have some success growing melons in Cache Valley. Good flavor, abundant fruit, but the size of the melons are smaller than expected. How can I get larger melons? I have a drip irrigation system, but they still seem to be small.
Yeah, well, a couple things that can happen with melon size is size is related to variety. So you may be growing, the last couple of years we've been growing this French melon, and this French melon is only about the size of a softball. But we grow it because
so it's supposed to be like a one serving size.
Absolutely. You cut it in half, and it's kind of a one half for one person and one half for the other. But we just love it so much because the flavor is just off the charts. So, you know, it's become one of my favorites. However, fruit size is also related to where the fruit is established on the plant. So if you've got a transplant that you've purchased and then within a couple weeks after you establish it in your vegetable garden, it sets a fruit, that restricts the size of the plant and it also restricts the size of the fruit. So those early fruits that set on, we call that what we call crown setting. They set on too early. The plant doesn't have enough time to get big enough to be able to support larger size fruits. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that, you know, it just may need a little bit more fertilizer. You got a drip system, but if you're not actually feeding the plant, it would be like saying to your son or to your daughter, I'm going to only give you two meals today rather than three, and they don't grow nearly as fast as a result of that either. So, you know, a little bit more fertilizer and probably some nitrogen fertilizer is needed, and you can go look at our extension a publication on growing melons, and it will give you some recommendations for the timings and the amounts and that kind of stuff. And that's one way to what you're actually doing is you're growing a bigger plant, and a bigger plant supports bigger fruits. And then the fourth thing, I think I'm up to number four now, the fourth thing would be what you need to also think about sometimes is we need to kind of remove some extra fruits. Sometimes a plant just sets so many fruits at the same time that it restricts the size of the fruit.
So if you've got a cantaloupe, then how do you judge?
The average fruit, the average plant will probably support three or four, you know, 3-pound fruits.
Okay, so if you've got a hill that's got three plants in it,
You might say to yourself, well, yeah, I can grow more. But sometimes what happens with melons in particular is if you grow a hill of them, it acts like a single plant. So on three plants, you see, you're thinking I'm going to get more fruits. But what you've actually done is you've set each plant will set three or four fruits. But because there's all this competition there, they actually can't size up.
You mean it's taken me 48 years to finally
ask me that question? You know, the commercial farmers, the spacing that they have is they put their rows about 4 or 5 feet apart, and then they put a plant about every 2 feet. So the hill size, so effectively what they've got is about 10 square feet per plant. for a watermelon or a cantaloupe. Now what you'll get is you'll get fruits that are in that 3 or 4 pound range, or if you got a bigger type variety, you might grow fruits that are 6 or 7 pounds. So sometimes we just try to pack too many plants into too small of an area. And then what the plants do when there's a hill of them, you know, your hill is maybe a foot and a half across or something like that. You've got three plants in there. It acts like a single plant. And so if you added up the weight of all of those fruits, it would be like if you had a single plant that only had 3 or 4 fruits on it. The total weight of three is equal to the total weight of just that single one, but it had smaller fruits. Our smaller fruit number, but bigger fruits.
I feel like Homer Simpson.
Yeah,
Simpson.
Yeah, I know. You know, why didn't that? I know that before. So that's why we talk about these things. So that, you know, try that this year. Just if you've gone a hill system, go to a fewer plants, you're going to get bigger fruits. Well, maybe you want more fruit. So, you know, it's kind of this balance again.
But instead of being 5 to 6 feet apart, I can have hills 2 feet apart.
That's correct.
And I can have the rows 2 feet apart. Or the rows should be?
The rows should, you probably at the in the home garden, maybe 4 feet apart
okay.
you can get by. The commercial farmers do them a little bit wider, but then, you know, they're really trying to get maximum production, and they're also kind
getting
of targeting.
Equipment.
They're targeting at a particular fruit size.
With just a couple of minutes left in the program, if you'd like to get in a question or comment, our toll-free number is 800-826-1495, or email us a question, zestygarden@gmail.com. I wanted to ask you a question about asparagus.
Yep.
So I didn't cover it last year. I had great asparagus, but I didn't cover it in the fall. Should I help it along by putting some straw down now before they start coming up? So it's
well, you know, straw, we've done a little work with straw. The only bad thing about straw is that it keeps the ground cool, and so the spears will come up later. So sometimes that's good because you avoid some of the frost that still can occur, which damage the thing. It also gives you some weed control, so that might be useful. But we also have seen if you had problems with slugs or snails in your garden in the past, straw is a nice place for slugs and snails to harbor themselves, and so then they feed on the spears when they come up.
You don't want
and
that.
So you don't want that. So, you know, I always tell people with straw, yeah, there's benefits to waiting before you put it out, and then that gives you the summer weed management that you want in and around that asparagus
so
bed.
I shouldn't be too concerned about it
no.
trying to push up through the...
No.
Because I have kind of more of a clay soil that gets kind of hardened.
Well, you know, if you leave the mulch there over time, that's going to just start to break down.
Okay.
And then that soil, the earthworms start to work it and it'll help out a lot.
Now, I forgot we had someone waiting on the line. We have
okay.
Chelsea in Hiram. Sorry, Chelsea. Thanks for waiting. What can we do to help?
Thanks. I had a question about onions. I normally plant my onions from transplants, and I block plant them. I don't
yep.
plant them in rows.
Yep.
And this year I wanted to try them from seed, so I sowed them a few days ago into black trays, and I've been keeping them in a window, but I was listening to you earlier, and I was wondering if I could just put them outside and let them sprout without doing anything else.
That's what I would recommend, because normally that's what the best way is to get really good onions for storage.
Okay.
The transplants, what you're doing is you're growing transplants now in the house, and then you're going to transplant those out. Those are kind of like the transplants that you may buy or the sets that you may buy. If you go down to one of the nurseries or garden centers, you can buy both. And so they mm-hmm. kind of act the same. So I generally recommend people just go out, find, figure out your planting area, make sure you've got them kind of in rows, and don't worry about too thickly seeding them. The seed is relatively inexpensive. And then when they do start to sprout, you can pull out the extra ones and use them like green onions until you get your final plant spacing, you know, later
okay.
on this summer. And
all right,
the quicker you can get them sown, the better off they'll be.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're
great.
Welcome.
Thanks, Chelsea. Last year, I had the best germination ever because I planted just from seed out in the garden.
Yep.
The soil was still cool, but great germination. My mistake was not thinning them soon enough.
Yeah.
And so then they didn't get Yeah, big as they could have
gotten. That's right. And you need about, you know, maybe 3 inches apart. You know, that should be your final plant spacing. So if you had them 3 inches on the square, then you're going to get a nice medium-sized onion bulb. It's going to store well. But we need to start seeding those things now. The other thing that people need to start thinking about is if you want to grow your tomatoes and peppers and grow those things from your own seed, generally up in Cache County here, we start planting out the middle to end of May. You know, it takes about 6 to 8 weeks. Well, here we are, the middle of March already. So, you know, if we're going to plant them in the middle of May, you know, we're about 8 weeks out. So you need to start be thinking about those kind of things. Probably wait with your squash and your melon transplants. But tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and those kinds of things, get started. You also want to start your broccoli and your cauliflower and your cabbage if you grow those types of things and want to grow them from seed yourself, because those are ones that we'd plant out toward the end of April. And we need about 6 weeks or 7 weeks to grow those.
So we're already on the
very tail end of that. So it's one of those projects that you may have to do this weekend if you want to grow your own plants relative to the appropriate planting time, which would be, you know, like the first week of May. So, you know, you're kind of in that 6 week window now. So be thinking about that, people. We got a lot of things to do here.
All right. Well, I wanted to make mention again of this guide that Dan has put together. It's a guide to common gardening questions, step-by-step recommendations for successful vegetable and fruit production. And pretty much anything you'd like to know about gardening is in this guide. It's available at garden.usu.edu. That's the Utah State University Cooperative Extension website for horticulture.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah.
So you can find a lot of things about pests things.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a few things that are for sale. This tends to be one of the things that's for sale. But eventually it will become as an online access piece.
Okay. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Quite welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and I do have a few items I would like to mention for different events happening around the Strait. There's a fruit tree pruning demonstration this Saturday, 10 a.m. to noon, and it'll be in the Old Enoch School Library at 4763 North Santa Fe Trail, and then end in the Enoch City Community Orchard. USU Extension experts will show you the art and science of proper pruning practices so you'll be ready to prune your fruit trees. And dress for the outdoor conditions and come ready to learn. The cost is $3, and it's free for master gardeners. All participants must register, and you can just do that through the USU Extension website. There's also Pruning 101, Waking Up the Landscape. It's March 22nd from 10 to noon at the Visitor Center in Cedar City. And then on Saturday, March 23rd, from 11:30 a.m. to 1, learn the basics of gardening season extension, including how to get an early start using plant covers, when to start seeds, and ideas for small backyard greenhouses. That's at the Utah State University Botanical Center in Kaysville. Registration is also online through USU Extension there. And then backyard beekeeping is April 5th from 10 to 12 in Cedar City. And extension, it's $5 or $3 for master gardeners. Again, registration is through the Extension website. Thank you for joining us for The Zesty Garden. And we'll be back a week from now, 10 o'clock. So stay tuned.
The Gardening Show is produced by Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. The Gardening Show is a production of Utah Public Radio. You're listening to KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.